for Abby seminar. I mean, hardly needs any introduction. Most of us have started puzzling about quantum theory by looking at this textbook. Today he's going to talk about QCD and the fabric of space.
Okay, let's see. The subject matter is speculative to the point of being toxic. And also very incomplete. This talk, you can see the March 04, it's almost a year old. Since that time, I've been retired for a few years now, retired from particle physics per se, hadron physics and real hands-on stuff for this kind of thing. And I took a year off, really, from hard thinking, wandering in the mountains on the Teton Range in Wyoming. And that's a good way to sort of cleanse one's head from thinking about physics, and it succeeded. Now I'm coming back up for air. From the title, The Fabric of Space, I'm serious about this fabric. And as you'll see in the middle of the talk, the speculation is whether what I would like to see about fabrics has anything to do with what the loop community is involved in with spin foams and the like. So that's one of the motivations for coming here, other than just the pleasure to be a PI. The general motivation for the talk comes to the colloquium next Wednesday, and although I'll touch on it in the middle of this talk. So without further ado, let's just get on with it. The basis for this talk, not for my motivations in general, but for this talk, goes back to Zeldovich in, I don't need a pointer, and most of your people. I go back to Zeldovich, 1968, who noticed a numerical curiosity. Oh, hey, oh, perfect. Thank you. Is this the official one?
It's the official.
None of these laser things. Huh? Oh, wonderful. I love it. What? That's right. You're with it. Be careful. I hear what you're doing. I've already heard what you're doing to speakers. Okay, so he noticed that the QCD scale, relative to the other cosmological scales, is a third of the way between the Planck scale and the cosmological scale. For him, there was no QCD in 1968, but there was the proton mass, which is what he used. The proton mass is a measure of the fundamental scale of QCD, lambda QCD. They're proportional. The lattice people calculate the constant proportionality. Here's the QCD scale of Planck units, 10 minus 13 centimeters, relative 10 minus 33, so 20 powers of 10. And the cosmological scale, which is 10 to the 28 centimeters, relative to 10 minus 33, 60 powers of 10, give or take a little, so that this is the cube root of this. So here it is. The cube of the QCD scale is proportional to the Hubble scale in natural units. And the question is this an accident? Chances are it's an accident. Okay. I mean, these are two different, very, very different quantities. But on the other hand, maybe it isn't. And that's the working assumption we're going to make here in the talk. It's not an accident. And there's some meaning to it. Because after all, cosmological constants has to do with vacuum, and lambda QCD has to do with the QCD strong interaction vacuum. But, and we tend, tend to compartmentalize our thinking. I think it's fair to say most people do, not everybody does. They're thinking there's the QCD's action, and then there's the cosmological action. And on Mondays, you talk about the QCD's action, and on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, you talk about the cosmological action. But there's only one vacuum, after all. If you want to unify your thinking, there's no better place to start, it seems to me, than the vacuum. Right? Because there's the same scale for all the vacuum, namely infinite wavelength. Not infinite, it's very large wavelength. So maybe there's a connection. And of course, it's not only Zeldo, but there are other ideas that hint in this direction. If you dredge around in the literature, a few names come up, and I've probably left out some others, but here to give you some of them, there's Schutzhold, who wrote a paper here, decided, so maybe the vacuum energy is linear with the Hubble scale, and it's an essay. And there's a paper by Camaro, which is, I think, even a little more vague, that tries to connect it up with holography in some way or another. There's a curious paper, or papers, by Jack Ng of North Carolina, who has an uncertainty relation involving the cube of the position uncertainty is related to, if you like, the cosmological scale. If you're trying to measure things at the cosmological scale, there's an uncertainty associated with where you are and what you're doing, which has this kind of relation, which says that you don't, if you're trying to measure the size of the universe, you're going to be uncertain to the QCD scale when you do it. I don't want to go into that detail, although I've got a transparency or two. And if you remember and ask me at the end of the talk, I can give you 5 or 10 minutes on Ng's argument if you care. Anyway, it has that cube relationship to it. And then there's my own motivation, which comes from multiple universe, thinking about multiverses and multiple universes, consider an ensemble of universes. This is next Wednesday's talk, so I'll do it very briefly. And I want this ensemble, somewhat like string theorists do, to allow different values for the fundamental constants as you go from one member to another. But unlike the string theorists, I assume a theory of everything, which has very few fundamental parameters in it, like 1 or 3 or 0, which some people thought was the case 20 years ago, instead of 10 to the 500, which is what the consensus is building towards nowadays. So if there's 1 or 3 parameters or something like that in the theory of one of these vacua, then the 30-odd parameters in the standard model have to be correlated with each other. You just can't vary them independently. And so I made a guess as to what the correlation might be. And so this is the guess. And these are various vacuum mass scales. This is the size of the universe measured in terms of the dark energy content of the universe. In other words, how big is the considered horizon? And by definition, that means that the dark energy scale, which is milli-electron volts or millimeters, fourth power of that quantity is the dark energy density. So the dark energy scale, by definition, will vary with the size of the universe, because that's just a tautology. And on a log-log plot, it's a square root relationship. And then the assumption is, basic assumption is that the other vacuum parameters, like the electroweak Higgs condensate or the QCD lambda QCD, which governs QCD condensates, do a similar thing, and that they flow with the size instead of being constant with the size. And if they flow, what's the most natural way that they should flow? This is just out of the hat, guesswork. It's that they flow to a fixed point. Where should the fixed point be? It should be such that if you have a tiny universe, all the scales are the Planck scale. Tiny universes have only one scale, that's the Planck scale. Our universe has lots of scales, then you've just done a log log plot, tie those two things together in straight lines. And if you do that, you find that the exponent of something of QCD is very close to a third, that's a Zeldovich relation. Lots of people have noticed that the exponent for the electroweak scale is close to a quarter, namely you're halfway between the dark energy scale and the Planck scale. Then the gut scale as well, it's 12 if you care. So if you do this, then you have a almost parameter-free way of describing the properties of different universes. And if nothing else, it's fun. You can choose a size, and now you know, in fact, all the gauge coupling constants values, you know the vacuum values, and you can ask all the questions about what these universes look like. Is there nuclear matter? Is there atomic matter? Are there stars? Are there whatever it is, you know? And you can address those questions, which I addressed in a long paper 3 years ago. And of course, one of the questions that comes up surfaces, you cannot not ask this question, are these universes habitable? Whether you want to think about entropics or not, you cannot not ask that question. So once you ask the question, you can answer it too. And there's only a narrow band of universes around our universe, which is obviously habitable, which are acceptable. And the triple alpha reaction in stars is a limiting factor, and it's about a factor of 2 bandwidth, give or take something. So there's a narrow band in here where habitability is allowed, and therefore there's some partial understanding of the old hierarchy problems of why the standard model parameters are so different from each other, the vacuum parameters. And the answer is that because our universe is large, if it were small, there wouldn't be that disparity. Because it's large, and because these scaling rules are true, there is a disparity. And so you have some insight as to why the hierarchies. Yeah?
Can you say again what the horizontal axis is? It's some sort of master coupling constant of the theory?
No. This is just the Hubble scale associated with these universes, which are assumed to be similar to our own,
so that
with an FRW cutoff, which asymptotes to the third space.
It's the Hubble scale
of the future.
Of the future.
Yeah.
The asymptotic value of the Hubble scale.
Yeah. So it's basically the dark energy thing. Right?
So in this model, the dark energy is constant with time, with ordinary time.
The dark energy is constant with time. Within a universe, these parameters are unchanging. So I'm not telling you, when I talk about scale, I'm not talking about the FRW scale, time-dependent scale. Everybody gets confused with this. And I know that that was your confusion or not, but it's a scale.
I'm trying to avoid that confusion.
Yeah. Good. Congratulations. Most people fall into the trap. And I haven't figured out yet how to describe the idea without people falling into the trap. But this is the variation of parameters are universe to universe, not within a single universe, with one exception, which I'll go into Wednesday, which is interesting.
You say all the hierarchy problems are solved. So you solve the cosmological constant hierarchy problem.
Well, yeah. And why the electron mass is small compared to the top quark mass, for example. It's just that they flow in the same way. They start here, they end there. Top quark starts here, ends there.
Cosmological constant.
It starts here and then it's there. Well, that's almost the tautology. That's input rather than output, really.
But I'm still not sure the answer to my question was yes. What is it that's governing this final value of the Hubble scale? Isn't it some microscopic coupling constant that is considered?
Could be, but I'm just taking the universe as it is.
So you're assuming that they're different universes.
I'm assuming it's an ensemble, that the members of the ensemble, at least some subset of the members of the ensemble, look like our own universe, more or less, but not exactly. There may be other members of the ensemble that are very different, but I'll restrict to the subset. This is really for next Wednesday, so I want to move on. Save the questions, think about some more, I want to hear them. But they're a little off the subject. This is just to motivate why I'm interested. I got to start. Why I'm interested in the problem. So I've traded in, yes?
Can
possible to find a European
What's
is there anything
between? Anything between? Could be. We don't know about it, so I can't put it in. There could be, sure. This is just what we know, and it's real. This is a cartoon of the real situation, probably. I mean, the real thing is probably not like this. I mean, it would be a miracle if it were like that. But what I need is just they start out that they move. They start out this way, and in fact, the details of how you get from here to there don't matter as far as this anthropic argument is concerned, because bandwidth of habitable universes is so narrow. So just a general idea. We don't have to have a precise fixed point. This may be a region. There may be structure in the region. Most likely there is. When you get up to the gut scale, all sorts of things happen. These things join, or they branch, or there's other branches. But that's a general idea. And so I see this hypothesis worth making because of the progress in that one, I feel anyway, in thinking about the hierarchy problem. I don't worry about the hierarchy problem personally anymore. But what I have to worry about are these exponents. Where did they come from? It's out of the hat. And so there has to be some dynamics, if that idea is all right, there has to be some dynamics which explains why these exponents are what they are. Out of the theory of critical phenomena, maybe they're like critical exponents in renormalization group lore, or maybe this is just really one-third, which is what I'm going to talk about here, where there's some reason why it's one-third. One or two other motivations. How long do we go? When do you pull the plug? Yeah, at quarter three, something like that?
Yeah, we started at late, so.
And I want to push a little bit, but I want to calibrate how fast I'm going. Another argument before I, which is curious, Marvin Weinstein and Ratina Khoury, who's visiting us, written some nice papers about Hamiltonian methods in cosmology, and which is somewhat related to the Luc Bourgeois kind of cosmology, although they get a different answer. But if you do the following simple exercise, you put the present day visible universe in a co-moving box, if you like, compactifying it for us, periodic boundary conditions through the box. And so we have a time-dependent volume in the box, which grows with the FRW scale factor. Now, literally vacuum out all the dirt. That means vacuum out all the baryonic matter, all the dark matter, all the radiation, leave nothing behind except the dark matter. So you have to have a very good vacuum cleaner. So you clean out everything. Please clean out everything except the dark energy, and then run this backward in time. And that's what happens. And then, so you do mini superspace quantum mechanics on this system with only the dark energy. So it's a de Sitter problem with this compactification, and that's what happens at early times. And what happens, what they find is it bounces. And when it bounces, if you set things up in this way, it bounces when the volume is of order of the QCD volume, not the plot scale volume, much larger. Look at their papers, put in the numbers. They don't emphasize this, but it's true. And why does that happen? It's easy. It's just the uncertainty principle, because you look at the total energy in the box. And that's the dark energy density times the volume. So mu is mu to the fourth is the dark energy density, mu to the fourth times the volume. And there's a characteristic doubling time for this box, for the box to double its dimensions, which is the Hubble scale. And so when you have the energy time uncertainty relation, when the total energy in the box is afforded the Hubble scale, you have to expect that quantum effects will occur. And so you put in the numbers, and you find the volume, here it is, a total mu fourth. I did the arithmetic right, and Hubble scale is mu squared over m Planck, and that's the FRW equation, and the one step of algebra here, and you see again that it's u squared is Hubble scale, so the volume is inverse with the Hubble scale to the first power, and it's the land of Q C D scale. And I'll come back to the hint of why this might be reasonable and interesting again later on. So there's all this fragmentary hints that maybe one should think about this. But the main one comes from Mr. Somebody must know this gentleman. I don't know the pronunciation of the name. Padmanabhan or Padmanabhan?
Paddy,
I know. I'm in correspondence with him, and so I know him as Paddy. But I've never met him, and I was told the pronunciation recently. I always said Padmanabhan, but then I was told it's Padmanabhan, and well, how do you say it?
Don't
mind. There's no expert. No expert.
It should be Padmanabhan.
Padmanabhan. Okay. It's official. I'll try to say it that way. Thank you. And there's a whole flow of papers, but there's some long and complicated and some short and simple. I read the short and simple ones. And I'll paraphrase the variation on the theme. It's a very simple connection of ordinary GR, Einstein-Hilbert style GR, with thermal gravity, which is this business of entropies and associated with horizons and all of that. This is a slight variation on his theme. And which I want to sketch out because of the language, which I also find interesting. So instead of looking in static metrics, at, we're going to look at it. Ordinary Schwarzschild black hole, but not in the static metric, but in kind of a Goldstrang, which is this version, which has flow velocity dear to the heart of people like Bishop Olovic and Pat Heiser, people who make condensed matter analogies of gravitational phenomena. So here's the metric. If you have a static metric and radial symmetry, the velocity flow is radial. This velocity function is radial. Square of the velocity we'll call u. And this describes all the familiar systems. Schwarzschild u is 1 over r. Consider u is r squared. Reissner-Nordström is 1 over r squared. If you want mixtures of these things like Schwarzschild consider, you just add the u's and you get the answer. It's all very simple, and you can make a Fourier transfer formation from here to here, if you like, and get the static metric in the usual form with the U's. So I assume that's not unfamiliar to you folks. And from there, then, you can go on and do Einstein equations. Less familiar to you folks, I expect, is the fact that when you do this, and calculate the full Riemann tensor in the natural coordinate system, and with two indices up, two indices down, it's incredibly simple. It's linear in U. This is true for the most general Pan-Levé-Goldstrang metric, where the velocity function is an arbitrary function of R and T. And to my knowledge, this has never been stated as a theorem in the literature. It's been proven, and the only place I know where the proof is in a paper by Uwe Fischer and Matt Wieser in the condensed matter part of the archives, where they were explaining to the condensed matter culture the connection between emergent gravity and what the condensed matter people do. And so they just went about calculating Pan-Levé-Goldstrang with these metrics, with the which are the foundation metric for considerations of emergent gravity. They wrote down and just calculated the Riemann tensor and all the various quantities in general. And there it is. You just look at the answer, it's quadratic in V or linear in U. You're trying for a direct proof. It's non-trivial. I've tried. I'm not very strong in geometry and arithmetic these days, but I can tell you it's non-trivial and hard work. And I don't know of a theorem. I went to Bob Wald in Chicago and asked him about it, and he said there's a theorem by a gentleman named Zanthopoulos. I looked up the Zanthopoulos theorem, and he uses Einstein's equations to prove his theorem, which otherwise has direct bearing on this. But this is independent of Einstein's equations. This is pure geometry. There's no use of Einstein in here at all. And it's true. And generalization. But anyway, it's very simple. And it's also easy to see that there's a duality relation which gives you the back and Einstein equations automatically. You just say that the top block is the same as the bottom block. That's kind of duality where you just flip the upper with the lower, change all of the coordinates appropriately, and that tells you this equals that, and you solve it, and you get the Schwarzschild Sitter metric as a difference. So duality is a purely geometrical criterion, which I find curious, and especially in the context of loops, because the duality is so central in Ashley-Graf formulation. I'd like to learn more about what's really going on, what's the machinery underneath. I should have said that, in fact, before I started the talk, that my coming here is not to give talks, even though I have the responsibility to give two, but to really learn. And I wanted this talk to come early and arrange it with Lee so it would be early for the purpose that what I'm doing really needs feedback. If it's nonsense, I want to know it. If there are connections with what the other people are doing, I want to learn it. And so I'm here to learn, here to try to exchange and get more educated, especially on the loop culture. And for that reason, wanted this seminar up front. I'll come back to it. It's really a double dual. You replace R. I'll come to it. So now here's the main point of Padmanabhan. You look at the standard action of GR, which is the scalar, the standard of Grandjean, and look at it as a functional now of this U, the general U, general radially symmetric U. And what he finds, and I don't know if this, I should use the word surprisingly or not surprisingly. When I talk to the string theorist experts at Stanford on this, they're not surprised at all. And I'm not sure I understand why they're not surprised, but they've got enough experience in this that they certainly are not surprised. But I want to learn from you whether you're surprised. Anyway, it's a perfect derivative. So there are two terms. There's the ones with these U double prime. This is the upper part of the Petrov matrix. This is the lower part. And it's a perfect derivative, the whole thing. So that means that you can evaluate the action on a horizon using the definition that the horizon is U equal 1, clearly. So we saw that metric before, that the first derivative U is a surface acceleration, and therefore you can assign a temperature under to it. And when you work this out, the action on the horizon, the surface term evaluated on the horizon, you get two terms, one from the upper part of the matrix, one from the lower. And this one is just TS, where S is pi r squared, the area in Planck units. The numerical coefficient is right. The other one is the mass. So gee whiz, here's thermal gravity coming out of almost nothing. So you can say, gee whiz, that's not the point of why I'm doing this. The point is something which Padmanabhan doesn't emphasize himself, whether he should or not. So here's the mass, here's if it doesn't matter in fact whether you consider it on the interior or Schwarzschild on the outside, you'll get the map. And the main message here, though, is that the TS piece, if you use the sitter metric, static and sitter, not where inside of the horizon, but the TS term is an integral of r squared u prime. If u itself is r squared, so that this is the integral d by dr of r cubed, which is r squared dr. So it's just an integral over the volume. You get the entropy as an integral over the volume. Same way you get the mass as an integral of the dark energy density over the volume. And that to me is just a little bit curious. Let's see, there are other things here I can jump over. If you're interested in all the other Ricci-Einstein temperatures, there's thermogravity all over the place. Ricci tensors, derivative of TS is analogous to the Einstein tensor the other way around, and so on and so forth. So it looks, it smells thermogravity from beginning to end, and not worried too much.
In order to get the entropy, you must have some definition of what you mean by entropy.
Yeah, pi r squared in the Hawking definition, or the Bekenstein definition.
So you're taking it as, you're taking your definition to be the area.
That's right. You say that that's right. So in other words, the Einstein Lagrangian really looks like a thermodynamic action. It's TS plus U.
And that's probably why people don't know.
What?
Because it's a pi that way, maybe that's why it's not so surprised.
But it's usually not motivated that way, right? You look at a black hole and pump things in and take things out and so on. I'd like to find arguments don't really use it that way.
That's kind of what the result was, because it was the blocking of transparency and they showed it for a few seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm worried about the order of my transparency is worrying me too. So. I have problems myself. I'm skipping over a couple of them because of time. Just the one that you wanted to see? That's the one.
So what is the result there?
Okay, so here. Here's the d by dr of r squared u prime. U prime is a temperature. R squared is an area. So it's an area times a temperature. And this is a mass. This is just the Schwarzschild mass. So it's this term really that has the curiosity value.
But presumably this is just related to the thermodynamic length equations for black hole dimensions.
Obviously it has to be. It's a question of what's really working here, what's really going on. And in particular, that this entropy term was the integral over this. That's what I'm going to run with. That observation. You can call it an observation. Before I go that far, there's one more thing. At least one more thing to do with this game, and that's to look at the gravitational topological circuit, Galtonate, our ghoul. That's the ghoul I described. It's a double ghoul. In the Riemann tensor, you use two Levy Tarifa symbols to change R into something else. So it's have two Levy Tarifa symbols times two R's. And that's a topological object. It's called Galtonate, Euler number. And again, you get perfect derivatives and so on and so forth. You can work it out just to get the Euler number. Maybe not too surprising there. Anyway, so there's all this business. But what does it have to do with Zeldovich? So here's the notion, which obviously is very speculative, which is why I'm here. Try to sort it out a little better. So it's suggesting that the entropy might live in the volume, not on the surface. Now, my intuition down through the years of this entropy business is that you think of entropy as, I think it's also intuition, lot of people in the room here, that you've got this horizon, you divide it up into plaque areas. It's it from bit. Every plaque area has a bit of information in it, and you count it all up to the entropy in proportion to the area, so that the information is moving on the surface. Here it says it lives in the bulk. Maybe you can have it both ways. You get the same number whether you count up the entropy in the bulk or count it up to the surface. So maybe there's a one-to-one correspondence between bits on the surface and the bits in the bulk that are being counted by Padmanabha.
What the fuck is this?
The interior of the De Sitter sphere. This is De Sitter space. Static De Sitter space was De Sitter horizon.
Oh. Well, look, an interior guy that feels for the radiation from the surface, which is coming in on him. So he says that the photons are flowing the volume, which towards him. So he has the option to say that the entropy is from the flow of the photons coming in. And that would be a volume.
But the
no,
maybe so. Maybe so. Is there enough hope? You're thinking of a Hawking photon.
You put a thermometer. And you're going down static wave. Right?
Yeah.
So it's each constant by the field. You put a thermometer in the center, then you put the thermometer elsewhere, and you'll see it everywhere. It's not everywhere. So it's not surprising. So I agree with you that there's something to do about it, because the origin of the photons is on the surface. So there should be a surface restriction, but why not a volume restriction?
Okay, that's a big point.
That sounds like talking about the Hawking radiation. And that's what I understood. If you were talking about that, that needs to be added to the horizon.
I mean, the entropy of the Hawking radiation in the volume is not very large. What folks are.
Well, it could be very large anyway.
Are you thinking of the Hawking, Robert, are you thinking of the Hawking photons when you're talking about these photons? Or
I'm saying a simple thing, that if you put a thermometer on the inside of the static
pack, yeah. You'll measure the Hawking temperature.
You put the thermometer around, you see a varying temperature, an artifact of temperature.
Oh, okay, so the local temperature is very high in the heart of
the peak.
Okay.
I'm disturbed by what I say because it's due to a flux, a one-way flux, going towards you. So the temperature of the peak is not quite the usual one, so I'm a bit confused in what I say. Nevertheless, the thermometer will go up.
So you take it, you use the local thermometer, you use the local thermometer over the volume.
There's no doubt that the thermometer will indicate heat everywhere in that volume. For me.
Yeah, but most of the entropy is still there. Even in your picture, most of the entropy is going to be there.
So,
the surface.
Our outer horizon.
Okay.
So, maybe then you're on to a mathematical.
Okay, I don't want to challenge this now. We can talk about it later, but I'm betting against you. Yeah, well, next month. I'm betting against you, but I better go on. Because the Padmanabha says a uniform entropy density to the sphere.
And it won't be uniform.
That's right. Okay, and that's where I think the difference is. So that for some reason it's uniform for Padmanabha. But in any case, okay, suppose this is really true. You can think of it both ways. You can count from the volume, you can count from the horizon, you can take a one-to-one correspondence, you can count, if you like, the streams. Three ways of counting the entropy. You can count the streams, which is not a local way of counting. You can count the ends on the horizon, you can count the ends of the bulk. You get the same number, three different ways of thinking about it. Maybe they're all just complementary to each other. And it doesn't matter. In any case, bulk entropy is one of those. And if you put in the numbers for our universe, the entropy on the horizon is 10 to the 120, R squared, R is 10 to the 60 in Planck units. The volume is 10 to the 180, which is the cube of the distance to the horizon. Take the ratio, you get 10 to the 60, or 10 to the minus 60. Take the cube root to get a dimensional scale for the separation of these bits in the bulk, and it's a QCD scale. That's why it's here. It's talk. If it didn't come out that way, it wouldn't have been the talk.
What quantity that was? The quantity in the interior was the entropy density? What's the meaning of the entropy density in the interior?
That's, of course, the question. Yeah, I mean,
how did it come in?
But I don't have a meeting. No, this is the answer. I want the question.
Maybe just the background. Quantum field theory on the center spaces in thermal state, there is a constant density of temperature in center space. And therefore, it is meant to learn in the center space, you have a thermometer.
Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, this is a phrasing of a question, not a statement of an answer, on this transparency, obviously. And so, what to do about this? Here. Now, is the leaf.
So are your screens for the metal screens that people talk about the QCD screens?
At the moment, that's an open issue. That's open. And I'm trying to search for what the screens mean. Right, they could be a physical, and in the condensed matter analogy, they might be a physical vortex line. No, all I did was draw some lines. That's all I've done. So now the question is, what do the lines mean? That's what you're asking. That's what I'm asking.
Calvin Wixler doesn't care. This is just the area of the horizon divided by the volume and size.
That's right.
So that happens to be lambda QCD in our universe.
Yes.
But that calculation doesn't care about those strings.
What you say is true, and that was the first transparency that built over, basically. Now try to put a little more meat on the bones.
I'm assuming that there is a zeta horizon in our universe?
Yes. Wait a little while, and we haven't considered the horizon as long as the dark energy is a cosmological term.
But there hasn't been, for most of the history, there hasn't been such a horizon.
Just wait, it's there.
Can I make a suggestion that we let DJ go on and present what he's presenting to us and not challenging on every point?
If you're willing to wait, if you're willing not to fail out of quarter three, I'd love it. But because this is just exactly what I need. But if we've got a deadline, then we better go with Leon. And we're doing all right, actually. Anyway, the way I like to think about it is, and this is very speculative, the lattice. To put this in the lattice. And the coordinate transform out of Padmanabhan, out of the static De Sitter space, and look at the De Sitter space in FRW language, where you've got a translation. If there's a bulk entropy here, there's got to be bulk entropy in the FRW De Sitter space as well. And since you've got a translation group there, that's the easiest geometry to entertain this notion. In other words, I want to leave the spherical symmetry, the static metric, and assume that the bulk entropy still makes some sense. I mean, you have to. I mean, the bulk entropy in one space-time is going to be the coordinate transformation. It's still got to be there. And in the FRW, it's got to be uniform, just by ordinary symmetry arguments. So that's step one. Go to FRW. Keep it considered. The other thing, though, is once in FRW, assume that these strings organize themselves into some kind of a periodic structure, like a lattice, or I would say a fabric. So that's where the fabrics come in. The question is why a fabric as opposed to the usual tangled mess that you people here always deal with. So I want to motivate the lattice. This is somewhat deep left. Next two or three transparencies are somewhat independent, I think, of what I've been talking about. And a question just for the loop community per se. Why don't you look at the possibility of restricting these huge state sums over to the subspace, sub the sub-configurations, which are lattice-like. So why do that? Okay, why do that? Why consider it? And first thing is, why not? Maybe nature is that way. We're blessed. I mean, general relativity is very general. Metrics are very general. But our universe is flat. We're blessed with a flat universe with a translation group. Not all the condensed matter systems of worlds are the complicated messes of configurations like liquids and polymers and so on, where the most general sum is the right sum to do. And sometimes you get away with murder. Condensed matter people get away with murder by just summing over the configuration group by a lattice. And it doesn't follow easily from first principles. I know how hard it would be for a condensed matter person to invent a crystal and convince people there was a crystal in the world if nobody had ever seen a crystal. Right. It might be pretty hard. I don't know. So it's a possibility. It's a simple possibility. Why not? So that's the first argument. But there's a better argument, and that is that, and this comes out of emergence, especially Bolovic, that if you do have a momentum space in your theory, which really requires translation, something like a lattice underneath, if you do have a good momentum space underneath, the internal symmetries of the standard model can come out. So what you need is from Bolovic's point of view, is a structure which has a Fermi sphere, Fermi surfaces, on which there are Fermi points. It really should be called Dirac points. And these are a phenomena that occur not in the most simple textbook condensed matter systems, but things like helium-3, certain high-temperature superconductors, you get them asymmetric, P-wave or V-wave correlations among the degrees of freedom to do it. But at the Fermi points, as I understand it, say helium, what happens is that whereas the Fermi surface on most of the sphere is gapped, at the Fermi points, the gap vanishes. And so you have the availability of long wavelength excitations with no cost, little cost of energy. And furthermore, these things are Dirac-like or Beyer-like. Sigma dot graph is the Hamiltonian, just like the Dirac equation or the neutrino equation. So you get sigma dot grad out of these things, and since you're coupling a grad to a sigma that's topological and has a stability to it. Furthermore, so you can get relativistic fermions out of the dynamics. You not only get the relativistic fermions, you get gauge bosons, because these Fermi, position of these Fermi points can go under, can fluctuate, and the degrees of freedom associated with the fluctuations in the position of the Fermi points in momentum space can be identified with gauge potentials, and so you can get gauge bosons. And so Bolovic has a couple of chapters in his book on this sort of thing, and where did it go? Yeah. And if you, in the case of the actual physical vacuum, the vacuum of the world, the universe, if you have enough Fermi points, like 8 in space, you can get rather large gauge groups coming out. Like Bolovic's book, he gets SU4 color across the Poppy Salon, basically. SU4 color across SU3 left, across SU2 right, electroweak. And this is, you know, structure is negotiable, and these are the details of details. But in any case, Fermi points of vertices of skew, the fluctuations of these vertices in space give you QCD. Gluons without much trouble. In fact, you can sort of see along the body diagonal, you get the degrees of freedom, which are quark triplet, quark ended triplets, and leptons at the corners for the SU4. So all of this comes out by exploiting the existence of momentum space and the structure in the momentum space. Bolvik gets out and inroads into interpreting the symmetries of the standard model. Would be, I think, a very welcome thing from the point of view of loop graph. So that's the idea. It's obviously very speculative and not worth anything unless one does really something serious with it, which I have not yet done. That was supposed to be what I did this year instead of laundry. But it's obviously hard, but I think it basically I did a lot of chickening out. So we're in the FRW basis. And the idea is that and this is sort of motivated by the string history, the loop history, not the string history, loop graph history. That in some sense or other, we can think of the vacuum as a three-dimensional fabric. There are a lot of threads. Maybe there's just a lot of these, and there are vortices, physical, and there are holes in space-time. But let's make it Cartesian. Then the density of the threads is ordered to Planck scale. The notion is that most of the time, or almost all the time, threads go by each other without joining. So there aren't all of these nodes and vertices in this picture that the spin bulb has. So they just go by each other, and they form either a V of some sort or another, and no junctions. On the other hand, this is something that's supposed to be present in the FRW geometry, and if we put it in a co-moving box is expanding, and if you don't do anything, these threads separate from each other, and the ultraviolet cutoff redshifts, and you get the little disaster transponkian effects redshifting the infrared.
So what do the threads represent?
The threads are going to be what's that line that connected entropy on the horizon in the previous pictures, entropy on the horizon with entropy in the bulk. It's those lines which I'm trying to interpret.
Yeah, I didn't know what those lines were.
I don't either. The problem is trying to get this idea off the ground so one can make a hypothesis about what the lines are. Right? It's step zero that I'm working on. So your question is,
these are interpreted to be actual physical objects with energy.
They could be. The energy per thing in the bulk is a Hubble scale. It's extremely small, so the energy per thing is almost zero.
In problem of gravity, I can interpret every picture here as a state of quantum gravity in my community.
Every picture here. Yeah, I would.
And so I know what they are.
You know what they are. Good. All right. We've got 3 days for you to tell me what they are.
Well, I guess that also, because my understanding of loops is that they're not something you can localize in space. You can either construct a loop in space from your loops.
Yeah, so we would probably have to have a discussion about whether this is in matter, whether people work as classes, et cetera. But roughly speaking, these are flux of non-Hewlettian of electric flux associated with the gauge field, which is gravity from a
Yeah. They might be a flux, or they might just be a velocity, an integral ABL.
Yeah.
Right, so it might just be velocity. And I think that's more likely because they're not carrying any energy to speak of. So
you want to spin that work with very few one node per QCD?
Very few nodes. First approximation, no nodes.
One node per QCD?
Yeah. And one of the things that surprised me was clearly there are velocities in the lineage. This is all topology and all this stuff. And looked in Kaufman's book on knots to see what's in there about fabrics. In other words, if you take one thread and weave it, my shirt, for example, that's a fabric. It's got a lot of topology in it because it's
right.
The biggest weather. And you ask, what's the mathematical theory of my shirt? How do I know it's, what distinguishes my shirt from somebody's sweater out there that some lady knitted? And I look in Kaufman's book, nothing. I ask the experts, don't get any answer. Is there a theory of mathematical theory of fabrics? I haven't gotten an answer. So that's another question I'd like to, you know, maybe some of you know that, but I'd love to know.
It's a theory of handbook.
That's too general about that. I'm talking about really fabrics which you can map. You can take a map of your general fabric and make it obey a translation symmetry. In other words, the fabric admits translation symmetries. It could be infinite, but it has a unit self. So in fact, it's a very simple fabric in the sense that you can just take a unit. Once you know the unit cell in its topological structure, you know the whole fabric. It has to be simple. It has to be organized, and so on. And
it's topologically trivial. They never actually make loops with the thread.
Well, it depends how you terminate it. I take a piece out of my shirt. There's all these threads dangling. Now if I tie them back on each other, so I have a single thread that makes the entire fabric. The structure of the knots and all the knot invariants and knot polynomials are going to depend on how I tie those together.
So this,
I can tie them in such a way that the whole thing falls apart, it's trivial. Or I can tie it together in such a way that if you try to untangle it, you're going to get a god-awful mess. If you have a three-dimensional fabric, most of knot theory requires you to project that structure on a two-dimensional plane, which is obviously the wrong thing to do for this problem. So that most of the knot theory lore that projects things on a plane and then talks about Rademacher moves and all that stuff is totally irrelevant to a three-dimensional fabric. Absolutely irrelevant.
I just want to understand this picture. You've got to rise the volume, I divide it into little plank areas, and each plank area has a string flowing inside.
On the horizon.
Yeah, it terminates on the horizon and then in a plank area.
Yeah, or it might even cross the horizon and just mark it at the glass.
Okay, but at least, as the horizon gets bigger, more and more of these threads are created.
In the FRW geometry, yes. In the static geometry, really, space is not expanding. The matter is expanding through it. Because the circular metric doesn't change, so then it's a different issue.
So that's what I want to ask. So where are you? What coordinates? What space are you talking about?
FRW is the center.
How are you making it going? How are you making it going? And what coordinates? With a static system?
No. I'm in FRW where the scale factor and the exponential in time. In the global. Well, yeah, because it's global and it's global. It's more global than static. And it's less global than the most global, I guess.
It's pretty hard to get a nice idea of the body and the static.
The volume entropy, actually, if you look at the, and again, I have found I'm going to use here as to where the transfer agency is. I know it's here somewhere, but let me just say it. If you take a co-moving box to the Sitter space, and as time goes on, the box gets bigger, the dark energy density doesn't change, and therefore the energy increases. So U is an exponential function of time. Now, with this assignment of Padmanabha, you write T ds equals TU, where T is H over 2 pi, the usual Hawking temperature that's assigned to the Sitter space. And that gives you the Padmanabha entropy. So what it's saying is that the entropy, bulk entropy, is growing in exactly the same way as the dark energy is growing inside the box. TdS equals VU. No difference. So these two things are correlated. And the ratio of the energy to the entropy is a Hubble scale, H over 2 pi, which says that the energy per thing is a Hubble scale, almost zero. If there were no expansion, these things would have zero energy. So, now to guess, what are the knocks? What are the things that we're counting? They have to talk to QCD because that's where this whole talk started from. There's almost zero energy associated with them. So in the limit of no expansion, they're pure gauge. There's no energy associated with them. And they smell very topological, stringy. So the guess is that they're associated with the topological charge of the QCD vacuum. It's there to be exploited. So for those of you not QCD people, there's a CP violating term in action for QCD theta times E dot B. And it's pure divergence so that theta times if you integrate over space, it's theta times an N dot. N is the integral of the charge density, K nu is the topological current, and N is the topological charge. And the idea, usually one says that in the QCD vacuum, a pure value of theta, hopefully very small, ideally zero, small enough you're out of trouble with the experiment. And so theta is sharp, which means that N, which is the constant variable, is not sharp at all. So you have an N vacuum. The vacuum is made up of equal amounts of all possible topological charges. Due to its non-mixing and so on. That's the same picture. But now the idea is that maybe that's not quite true. There's a mean value of N, which in our universe is 10 to the under 20. So the constant is 12 N. So the topological charge is huge. It fluctuates a lot because instant times continually change the value of N at a rate which is the QCD scale. So you work out how much fluctuation there is over the history of the universe, and the total topological charge of our universe is 10 to the 80 compared to the 10 to the 120. So it's negligible. So here's the picture. Instead of this, get phase space for theta and N. In the conventional wisdom, where we have something like this. Big fluctuation. Very little fluctuation in theta, and a central value which is offset. Some people have asked whether N is physical. It's a gauge, variant quantity, but it could be physical. It doesn't have to be. It's associated with boundary conditions. In QED, there's an analogy to this theta phenomenon, which is background for electric fields. The analog of N dot is the holonomy AVX, the integral of AVX, from somewhere to somewhere else. But clearly, if you somehow, for example, backfire a torus and have a closed loop of AVX, and it's a flux, so it's gauge invariant. So maybe it's gauge invariant. And the same thing could be true of that. Depends on boundary conditions, global issues, and so maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So that led to some wrong-headed thinking. This idea may not be wrong-headed, but it's a vehicle implementation I made a year ago, I think it's wrong-headed. That this is even bolder, the idea that maybe this QCD business associated with the vacuum, since QCD is a gauge theory and so is loop gravity a gauge theory, maybe the QCD and the loop gravity can somehow be identified. Either it's identical or somehow at least isomorphic or some way they're connected. So I tried to see whether E dot B was connected with the corresponding quantity, our dual, in loop gravity, and whether, in fact, the degrees of freedom in QCD could be in some way or another connected with the degrees of freedom in loop gravity directly. and that the Astrakar action, the loop gravity action, is some leftover artifact out of QCD in some sense or another, which I don't know. If that's true, since QCD is SU3 and loop gravity is SU2 or O3, they're not the same group. And so you have to find a subgroup of QCD to identify if this is going to work in the real subgroup of the real rotations in the complex rotations of the obvious candidate, if this makes any sense at all. So try to work with that. It's getting late, so I'm not going to go through this. In any detail, question whether it could be identified. This is what I said a year ago. It's not easy, and I have no answer now. I try to compare the variables that the loop people use with the QCD variables, and there are clear differences. And I end up with confusion. You could read for yourself here. I like to restrict myself in loop gravity to the FRW cosmology on the Bode law, because first of all, it's the simplest case I can understand it, and it's also the most relevant case for what I want to do. Well, there's a lot more here, but I'm running out of time. I'm going to pick and choose. So there's all these analogies. One thing I find in this identification problematic, and I want to bring this up because I'm baffled by it, and that's down here. When one looks at the cosmology a la loops, here's the Einstein, the Astrakar term, here's the dark energy term, schematically after you've gotten rid of all the indices. And this is dark energy, and dark energy is electric in loop gravity. E is a momentum, and B is a coordinate in Hamiltonian language. And it strikes me curious that the momentum degree of freedom is what's responsible for dark energy, and the coordinate degree of freedom is responsible for the flow. It's not. Whereas most other ways of looking at the problem is the other way around. And makes me wonder, since the theory is self-dual, maybe it doesn't matter. Right. Mathematically, it may not matter, but conceptually, maybe it matters. In the same sense that if you make a dual transform of real QCD, some people think that's the way to look at confinement, by looking at the dual variables. You see confinement when you look at the dual variables, but you don't see it when you look at the direct variables. So from the point of view of points of view, I'm wondering, in the back of my mind, whether in some sense or other the simpler way of thinking about loop gravity might actually be with a dual transform, which I'm sure goes against the grain of everybody that knows something about the subject. But I throw it out as a future conversation topic, not much more, something that came in passing. So the rest of this is really fragments of ideas, which I'll throw out quick. One has to do with Lee's question a little while ago. If I think about FRW now, there's all of it. I mean, I'm thinking of the universe at the level of mini superspace, with the scale factor and its conjugate variable being the effective degrees of freedom, and that equivalent of Fock's very simple system. And the phase space of that system now is a squeeze state, which evolved out of something more quantum mechanical at early times. And so the boundary conditions I put on myself is that at most a semi-classical limit should suffice. I mean, when I look at this problem, I want to reduce it to something as simple as possible, not as general as possible. I want to know about our universe now and what it's made of now. We're interested in the microscopic structure now. So if that's the case, a nice little chunk of FRW space-time, as big as this room, is quite enough to deal with, you know, the stuff at the Planck scale. That, you know, it's a lot of universe right there. And so the complicated parts of the geometry may be able to be finessed. So I'm hoping that we can be semi-classical in the context of just taking a piece of FRW space-time out of the entire cosmos, that the internal structure, but when you do this, when you chop out a piece of the space-time, and if there is all this fabric structure underneath, you've exposed all the strings and string ends and whatever there are when you do that, and you have to terminate in some way or another, and define boundary conditions, and define if there are fluxes in those strings, how many things there are. So that the state, the specification of the state will be the specification of how many strings, where they are, how much fluxes are through them, and so on. Specification of all the boundary information of what you got when you chop out this piece of space for space-time. But since we're now not at the beginning of time, maybe one could be classical in doing that and get away with it and not lose too much of the essence of the problem. So perhaps a classical generating functional which encapsulates all the information about these individual fibers and so on is sufficient for getting a sufficiently accurate description of what the contents of the FRW vacuum are and can be used to go from it. So I'm trying to dumb down the problem as much as possible without losing the losing everything. Like, I don't know, was it Einstein or someone who said, you know, Einstein defined them, you know, that you make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. And so the art form is to stop at the right place. So anyway, I hope this gives you a flavor of what I'm about. My list of things to do which I laid down a year ago and haven't done. Things here I would learn, like to learn here. Lower dimensional examples should be good for this problem because it shouldn't depend much on dimensionality except for technical difficulties. I'd love to see more mundane examples of loop gravity work, especially if handled by Goldstrom. And then this question I raised before. And standard gravity, there's things to do. I didn't talk about it very much, but the topology of this in itself. And the fabric models, there are again different geometries to deal with, which can simplify things, long skinny ones, flat thin ones, and then the boxes, of course. And to start with the simple small boxes, where the entropy content is small compared to unity, I mean small compared to the QCD scale, so there are none of these knots and things have to be considered. Let's say the knots, the entropy is the associated in the expanding universe with the formation of this new string, right? So that the entropy density is associated with the process which creates the new string that keeps the ultraviolet cutoff at the right place. So the one thing that's not on here is an increasing realization during the year that one should not stop with just these fabric degrees of freedom, especially if there are E dot P type terms generating anomalies that work, because the best way to understand their effect of E dot E terms is to couple them into the fermionic degrees of freedom through the triangle and other anomalies. And so it may be best to not stop at this point, to throw in fermion degrees of freedom right from the start and consider them as well. And especially how they couple to these topological stuff. And that gets back then to the transponking problems that most everybody has been working on for a long time. I'm not sure that that's going to be easy. Anyway, that's it. Thank you very much for your patience. We had another discussion, so anybody wants to move right away, you should do that. But if there are questions, maybe the ones who are interested in asking. But you are going to be around?
I'll be around through next Wednesday. So I look forward to meeting you all and learning what's going on here.
I just want to make you all sick. That way, that if a picture like this is right, would the Big Bang scenario change at small volumes of early time? So that, in fact, QCD itself changes lambda QCD.
Yeah, that's next Wednesday.
Oh, that's what you're going to
talk about. Well, one thing I can say now. You just look at this concordance model and what happens. You have inflation, and then inflation ends, and we get the Big Bang radiation-dominated universe, which cools off and expands until matter domination, and nowadays where the dark energy is taking over. But during inflation, there was dark energy, huge amount of dark energy. And in the slow roll approximation, almost everything is constant. Dark energy, the way I think of it, there's a constant cosmological term, and then an infiniton degree of freedom on top of that, and a part 10 to the fifth or smaller, a very small ramp potential that creates the slow roll and all of the CMB phenomenology. So in the early universe, there's a huge cosmological constant, from this point of view, during the inflationary era. And according to the rules I gave you here, that just corresponds to a different universe, a different standard model parameters. So one way to play the multiverse game, which this is Wednesday's talk, is during inflation, all the standard model parameters are different according to that thing there, which in fact, it's very reasonable that the inflationary dark energy scale is accounted for by phenomena at the QCD or grand unified scale itself. So they all merge.
Yeah, but the QCD scale itself may be different from what it is now.
Exactly. I mean, lambda QCD, if that's true, lambda QCD is like 10 to the 16th GeV during that period, all right? So it's, and the electric scale is also 10 to the 16th GeV, which says you're probably unified when you're that small. Then you have a unifying group governing the evolution during the inflationary era. So the question is, and it gets even worse than that, because you can ask the question, if the standard model parameters are allowed to change universe to universe, what about the velocity of light, Planck's constant, Newton's constant? And normally, one can argue that if you have an ensemble of universes that are causally disconnected, you can set those three parameters equal to one in all of the universes, and it's just a convention. But if you've got, you know, universe one decaying to universe two, there's a boundary there, and you can't do that anymore. So you have to entertain the notion of whether HBAR changed discontinuously between inflation and not. So that gets a big deal in a hurry. It's high stakes thinking, and not obvious that it's consistent with data.
With
data, right? I mean, there's a real experimental issue involved. It's not just a lot of blah, blah, blah. I mean, is this hypothesis make sense? Can you have a discontinuous change in the velocity of light and Planck's constant between then and now? Or is it ruled out by something or another? Internal consistency or just what you see in the data? So, yeah, yeah.
I didn't get some of what it is. Are you actually suggesting that for some time about the entropy can be equally well defined on the surface and then or inside the bottom?
Yes.
I'm suggesting that. Yeah. Then you drew something that kind of out and just some kind of things, I don't know what that means. But so there's one up here and then it's attached to the surface of the valve. And if so, suppose those one of these kind of strings are attached to some membrane, then you're actually adding some constraints to one of their ends. Then I don't think the number of states on the surface can be equal to the possible number of states inside their volume. Then how could their entropy be equally defined on the surface or and inside the volume? I don't know.
That question I don't know how to answer. the way I would I attempt to approach it is to start not with the spherical geometry in answering this, but to start with the Cartesian geometry of the FRW, the sitter space. As that expands, I mean, I've got this dense packed mess of strings in the FRW space. It's expanding up, and there has to be a mechanism for producing new strings as these old ones separate from each other. You have to have a string creation mechanism. It could be that each string is carrying a flux. The flux is time dependent and scales with the scale factor in some way or another. And the flux gets too large, the string breaks into two strings. And with these ends propagating outward away from each other. So you first start out with the nucleation. And then, for example. And so then these things spread out. And the entropy count would be the number of these nucleations output factor. So now you do this in a simple Cartesian geometry and get that straightened out, which I haven't done. Then it should be straightforward mathematics to make a coordinate transformation from the Cartesian de Sitter space, the FRW, and the Panleve-Goldstrom or static de Sitter space. I prefer the Panleve-Goldstrom, which is closest to Panleve-Goldstrom divulges here's the horizon. And the motions are like this, say, for an outgoing object. And if something's emitted from the horizon back inwards, it's delayed like that. So all of these string ends then would be following trajectory something like this. And so there'd be a general flow of string ends out through the horizon in Panleve-Goldstrom, which is described by the velocity function in the Panleve-Goldstrom metric and the density and all of this stuff. But this could be mapped, I think, figure out what it looks like once the geometry is straightened out as to how the nucleations occur in the FRW space-time, which has to be uniform in space, and it's uniform in space and appropriately uniform in time. There's a constant nucleation density per unit space per unit time. So I think this part is doable, to visualize how these things move, but the actual endpoints of the string, whatever that means, that's what I'm trying to find out what it means. These endpoints in the static thing are not static, they're moving, they're flowing. And so the marking of them is in terms of how they cross the horizon is just a convention. If when something crosses the horizon, you cut it. I think that's the way we do it. I don't think that's the way you do it, usually when you talk about punctures and stuff like that. You know, things going through the right, punctures and count punctures. So it'd be similar here. I hope that helps.
You must have some kind of mechanism to exclude the possibility that the those three ends of footstrings can join with each other.
That'd be further down the line. I understand what they are. I wish I could address that question. Yeah.
I guess this question just reflects my profound ignorance about the role of strings here, but I mean, do you associate entropy with all aspects of the string configuration?
No.
How do you decide what entropy should be associated with?
By the numbers.
But what's the principle? Which
the numbers.
Did they come out right?
Yeah. I mean, the first transparency was that this correlation of scales with flame with QCD makes sense, which may not. And then that I follow my nose and I find that the density of these things is the QCD scale. And then I try to interpret, you know, it's a very low density. So it's a density which vanishes in the absence of expansion. So it has to be something which is not associated with the fabric itself, or the microscopic structure. You count that stuff up, you get too much. So it can't be that. It has to be something else. And that's just.
Or you discover that it's not the meaning of entropy, or I just understand. I mean, you would think, you would thought entropy should be associated with all degrees of freedom, and if the strings involve degrees of freedom. So don't you have a question of why are you associating entropy only with this stuff and this, the numbers and not with other things?
I have the question of what entropy means in the context of general relativity, which is a big question mark from beginning to end. So I want to be just totally open minded about it.
But at the end of the day, you want to understand then really why this is the right definition.
There are a lot of things I want to understand at the end of the day. Lots and lots.
My aspect of entity. This is like a crystal, it's up to the ground state, so there's some point of coherence that doesn't have entropy. That could be like defects that they could be scattered around.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just a word.
Yeah, defect density. So I want to identify. Defect density, not the total stuff.
I have some thoughts about that, but I don't want to figure this time forever. But I have a less simple question, or I want to take it in a different direction, which is that because you said something very interesting, but in this part that you skipped over, which is the idea that the same degrees of freedom might be gravity and microconcentration at different scales, essentially.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of skipped over that.
Yeah.
So let me just, because I've been trying to find out about that, let me just push you. Okay. So there is local frame rotation in space, and there is local color, as to three color symmetry. Somehow you're conjecturing that they're the same, that a subgroup of the local color symmetry is the local frame rotation in space.
Yeah, in fact, the total, well, even worse than that, the actual color, the color itself is connected up with rotations in space, in the sense of the role of the glass. That the geometry of the color degrees, the geometry of these 30 point degrees of freedom in momentum space is, in fact, the geometry of the color degrees of freedom.
Okay, so that's the
so there's really a direct tie between space.
So if I understand it right, that's a different type. At least I understand that as a different idea. So let me try to separate them.
So that's not what you meant.
The Volokh idea, if I understand right, is that you make a certain crystal structure and you play the game that people used to play with fermions and lattice QCD, in which fermions only now we're trying to make, and it used to be that I don't remember the name of what this game was, but I'm sure you remember it. It used to be that there was an idea that there was a pattern of sort of flavors. You did lattice QCD with fermions, and then flavors could be something about where fermion was of lattice.
Yes.
And
the other one would be the entropy.
Right. And so what then becomes gauged, that is flavor SU2, is to begin with a discrete transformation on the lattice. And somehow then looked at it the wrong way by the fact that it becomes gauged. And so I try to understand Bogdan's idea, it's the same idea with respect to SG3, with some fundamental crystal structure, maybe in a steel network. And there's something that happens which gives you a Fermi surface and a Fermi point.
Yeah, the Fermi surface itself doesn't require a crystal structure. And I think as I was speaking, I was worried about what I was saying, in fact, a little in that regard, because I don't think you don't really need the crystal structure for the Fermi surface. The way I again, this is yet another line of speculation, but the way I like to look at the surface, the conjecture, what the surface of the Fermi sphere looks, or what the Fermi surface looks like, is if we have a periodic lattice, so that there's a unit cell, and there's a Fermi sphere in the center, and there's another Fermi sphere at the corner. This is one sphere. And so this is sort of a basic structure. This smells like quadrupole. If you've ever seen a quadrupole magnet in an accelerator, that's what it looks like. Here's the pole tips, here's the beam. So it has a quadrupole-ish nature, which probably is good in trying to get a spin to excitation to gravitate out. Now you put the Fermi points at the points of nearest approach in here. If you do that, and then suppose that there's some, in fact, you go one step further, which is a simplifying step, and say that these Fermi surfaces almost touch at these points, bend them up, bend them over. Then before long, you get an approximation where you can just make these rectangular. So if you go to the rectangular limit, where these are filled and these are empty, this is what you get out of quantization of a single Dirac particle on the lattice without any interactions whatsoever. You get what's called fermion double, you get doublers. So in each dimension, you have two places where the energy vanishes at large wavelength. And so these are all the excitations of doublers. So by going through this language, which is now condensed matter effective theory, you may eventually end up to a starting approximation, which is extraordinarily simple, even though you can't think of this as a theory on a fundamental lattice, and it should not, because it's really an effective theory at low energies of some much more complicated system, which went through all of this. Some in advance, not a whole of it. So, I mean, in terms of a working game, I can maybe retreat all the way back to the lattice with its doublers, and which have these simplifying features and this generation of many flavors out of almost nothing by this translation game. I know that that's what you meant. Although the doublers are the same thing as what you meant. But
so now we want to say that SG3 comes from that. SG3 color comes from
SG3 color is somehow associated, yeah, with the existence of these Fermi points on Q, and where if you like, and that's SG4 actually, it's not even SG3.
Fine, no, perfect. So, but then it doesn't, if this is in the context of a ground state of quantum gravity, it might be. It doesn't matter whether or not the gauge fields living on the edges of the fundamental loop from the quantum gravity are SU2 or U1 or SU5 or anything. This SU3 is arising as a collective degree of freedom, which certainly is certainly very attractive. But then it's decoupled. I mean, all it means is a theory in which the gravitational degrees of freedom are some sort of graph. You don't actually need it to carry us to any other particular label.
That should all be emergent. Yeah, it should be, it should evolve out of the geometry and the law.
The people in the quantum gravity world is not the artifact point of view who believe that the labels on the spin networks are too much structure. And
what kind of structure?
Emergent.
What kind of structure?
Too much structure. They refer to local rotations or local rent transformations. No, south should be in merchant. And that all that they really should be is a just a neighbor structure of relations.
Yeah, of course, one of the questions I would ask you and the other people is, I mean, when you wrote your paper with Rovelli and Luke Jacobson, someone one of the very early papers on the loops, you had the weaves, just the chain mail, I think the word was, for the paragraph there. And you didn't have any, right, you didn't have any of these junctions. None of the junctions appeared. And the question is, do you really need them?
Yeah, no,
I assume you do for some reasons, and I want to learn what they are.
That's,
we can talk about that.
I mean, there's a simple answer in this context. Like, you need the junction because when you compute the volume, you know, these guys are states, but when you compute the volume of the region, then the volume comes from the intersection. So these two states were looked at, and in fact, the problem is that they are there, but they don't contain any volume. The volume operator is just zero on that.
I don't work at the quantum gravity, but from an outsider, it's never been entirely clear to me that what you say is true, because I mean that's taking a very naive, in a sense, attitude towards what the volume operator is. It's finding that a lot of good is in the continuum of the gravity, and that it works by the operation in the.
I mean, there might be another
variables that you've chosen, but it seems to be possible that volume is a more indirectly defined thing.
Okay,
the method derives it in a somewhat more emergent fashion.
I'm just remembering the framework which was developed, that's the result. So there may be another framework, you know, but that's not.
Murad is absolutely right. It's something but the introduction of the importance of the volume operator became central for many, many technical developments that happened after that. So it's not that it's easily dismissed. And for example, if you want to couple to not a scalar field in particular, you want to be able to write a volume element.
This is a good answer for me. I mean, if you have to give up the volume operator to give up the junctions, that's a big price to pay, obviously, from where you're for.
And that would be nice if you could define the volume kinds of area, because even if there's no junction there, so if you measure there's area, then you're wooden.
The suggestion that there's a relationship between the three scales, the value QCD, the quantum scale, and the cosmological scale is very intriguing. And
I mean, that's where it starts, and then the next question, of course, is now what do you do with it? And that's what this talk will try to do.
I thought what you were going to say. My reconstruction from what I thought you were going to say, or what I'm about to say, is that the same age degrees of freedom, say some SQ3 degrees of freedom, behave dynamically according to QCD kind of dynamics, or according to gravity kind of dynamics, depending on what scale you're looking at. So that you don't have to have a duplication.
Yeah.
Whether it's ultimately emergent or ultimately fundamental, that there is some relationship between rotating in space and rotating in the space of possible forms, that we can unify them with the same degrees of freedom, doing different jobs for us at different scales.
Yeah, actually, I think that part of the reason of pulling in the two subjects was that, that in looking at the bulk entropy as something associated with QCD, you come up with E0B in this topological chart. And I say, well, now if I step back and say, that, you know, the bulk entropy doesn't belong to QCD per se, it belongs to gravity, that's where it came from. So therefore, in what sense does this QCD topological charge belong to gravity? And so I have to find something in gravity which maps from the QCD topological charge, for want of a better word. I don't know quite which is, you know, there's a relation, some kind of logical relation, somewhere between an identity or a map or an analogy or something, between that term and the raw material of gravity. And as of last year, I thought that the Gauss-Bonnet term was it. Our Google. But the Gauss-Bonnet term is wrong for this, because that's the one that I was demonstrating in these Penn-Mallet-Goldstrom things which interchanges two blocks, because it's very conserving. It has two ladies of E's times two R's. So it's very conserving. What I really want is the real our Google term, which vanishes across all ordinary metrics. If you need a vorticity or a rotation or something in the metric structure in order to see it. And so as of today, I think of, you know, how can I connect up the theta term in QCD with the real R dual term in gravity? And that gets into what Stefan Alexander is doing and all of that business. And how do the dualities in the gravity express themselves, you know, in conventional Einstein gravity? And so I start thinking about torsion and teleparallel connections and stuff like that to see whether I can find a connection.
And that's maybe not really know that Stefan has had some very. I get the small calls that I don't understand. And when she's talking about connecting the plot of planet QCD and cosmological terms, sorry, theta QCD, and the inertia parameter and cosmological terms, and I begin to see what's going on. And why I began to see what's going on, and I want to connect you to, is because of the wrong hole of the dark time, in which is the relationship between things which are chiral and theta QCD by which are cosmological terms.
Yes. There's clearly a certain amount of mutual influence between the
QCD
on these things.
You guys should talk about that.
Okay.
I don't prefer to step out and ask me to do
it. Okay, no, I actually agree with you.
He hasn't published anything.
No, I've had a message to a friend of also.
Cosmology.
Oh, he has something in cosmology about. The genesis related to things which are chiral and carrying break. And this is in some sense a development of that.
Yeah, that they're following and so on. I think I know who you are. I remember the past events. I'm here. Might be Tuesday, Wednesday. Well, through next Wednesday. So, I remember.